Talk given by Firoz Mehta on Saturday, 9th December 1978, for the weekend course on yoga in daily life, directed by Penelope Neal Smith at Missenden Abbey Adult Education College. Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, every religious discipline aiming at intimate relationship with the divine is a yogic discipline. We turn seriously to the practice of such a discipline in daily life only when we truly see that the wretchedness of the worldly life is due to our ignorance of the spirit, the Atma or Purusha, God or transcendence, call it what you will. What do we mean by the word spirit? That which is the one and only self-subsisting. It has no origin. It has no end. It is, it was, is, and everlastingly will be. Ultimate reality, you may call it. It is unconditioned. This self-subsistence or aseity or eternal being we confuse with intellectual projections out of our psycho-mental states of sense functioning, feelings, thoughts and volitions. Every concept of God or the ultimate that we produce is a projection out of our own imperfect minds, our own conditioned state, our own state of pain and suffering. It is not the reality. But that reality, that ultimate reality, is experienceable, although quite unstatable. Whatever we state is misleading in some degree or other. Therefore, you will notice one extraordinary thing in the history of the great religions of the world, that the founders of the religions and the true spiritual teachers of the world who have existed and exist now through the ages have spoken as little as possible about this ultimate reality. They have unhesitatingly affirmed it, absolutely affirmed it. Having affirmed it, they won't argue about it. What they taught was so to live in this world and not be of the world that it is possible for individual human beings to experience that reality, the totally beyond, the unthinkable, unimaginable, the nondescript, but which completely subsumes, contains within itself all that is manifest to us, constituted as we are. Now, yoga, or any yoga, is that which enables us to be released from obscurement by all our psychomental states, and thus to live fully awake to this transcendent reality, the Spirit. That is the fundamental meaning of yoga. This is the joining, if you like. You know that the word yoga is derived from the Sanskrit root yuj. The awakening of the Spirit in us is quite different from the consciousness of self that we have. It is not an awakening so much of our consciousness as a training which enables our subjective consciousness to become quiet, to become utterly stilled. And in that supreme stillness, the Spirit awakens. That is to say, the Spirit is never asleep. It is we who are asleep. But its activity stirs in us. And when that happens, it's something which is completely beyond our capacity to express in our poor concepts and words. So the awakening of the Spirit is quite different from the consciousness of self and from the knowledge, however detailed, of our own self and its ways, of our entire psycho-mental process, including the entry into and the abiding in deep states of consciousness, the mystical states as they are called, however sublime or profound they may be. So beware, if you want to be a true yogi, of ever saying that you as the individual realize the transcendent, or to talk in theistic terms, that God spoke to me. It is the transcendence which manifests through you, the unknowing one, the totally unresisting one. You can never know transcendence, but you can be taken up by transcendence into itself as and when you are in the supreme yogic state, the state of samadhi in its fullness, which can happen not merely when you sit cross-legged in meditation far away from the noise and bustle of the world, but any time, anywhere, it happens. And you don't know it when it happens. Afterwards, things begin to happen. Thoughts come in, concepts and visions which are the poor representatives of that experience, because that experience leaves an indelible impress upon the whole psychophysical organism. We must be very clear about this. Now, all our particular experiences, flashes of inspiration, spiritual or divine communications as we call them, all belong to the context of mortality, the realm of the finite, the limited, and hence measurable and comparable, the realm of the contingent, that which is dependent upon something else, the material or spatio-temporal, constantly changing and transforming. But the Spirit, the Purusha, or the Atma is the non-finite, the unlimited, the immeasurable, incomparable, uncharacterizable, the eternal. Now notice that these are all negative terms as far as our language or any language in the world goes. They have no opposites whatsoever. Immortality or eternity has no opposite. What is the common conception, for example, of the eternal? We say, oh, that which goes on forever and ever. That is quite incorrect. That which goes on forever and ever is spoken by us because we are conscious in terms of time, which is limited. And if we were not conscious in terms of time, there'd be no birth, there'd be no growing, there'd be no dying. That is not the eternal. And there are those who have said that the experience of those moments in our life which are timeless is an example of the realization of the eternal. No, it is not. Consider the language we use. Our moments of timelessness. And those moments come to an end. And you wake up into time again. So our concept of the timeless, our experience, however real it be, our concept of the timeless falls short of eternity. The eternal completely subsumes within itself both time and the timeless. Now, these things are extremely important for us to begin to try and appreciate, because otherwise we continually fall into all kinds of traps. And we have illusions about ourselves, we have delusions of grandeur and achievement and attainment and all that nonsense. And that has nothing whatsoever to do with the simple truth of yoga or of being a yogi. Now, are we beginning to see what yoga is about? Can we see and accept unreservedly that its objective in our everyday practice and life is the complete dissolution of the consciousness of separate selfhood through the utter extinction of all selfness? Selfness is not mere selfishness with its opposite unselfishness. Selfness is something much more inclusive and deeper than selfishness. These are not easy concepts. That's why I said that, or rather asked our chairman to say that it will be a concentrated lecture. Let us consider this together with a calm mind and a pure heart. Both man and cosmos are afflicted by the pain and suffering which characterize all existence. The very word existence means that which stands out of, ex out of, sistere to stand. That which stands out of, which has come apart, so to say. And what is it that has come apart? The total cosmos has emerged, the manifested cosmos, as we can see it and experience it, has emerged out of this absolute, this ultimate, unimaginable and unthinkable total reality, transcendence itself. Therefore, it is perfectly correct to say that man and the cosmos are afflicted in this manner and are in bondage. Spirit is unafflicted and is utterly free. We don't know what freedom is. Look at the history of man. In the name of freedom, we see the most extraordinary manifestations throughout the centuries of license, of stupidity, of cruelty, of everything which is non-human. Yoga is concerned with releasing us from this pain and suffering and establishing the freedom of the spirit, which is the only true freedom in us. Now, most of us are acquainted with yoga as the way of power, Shakti Yoga. The Hinduistic form of yoga. Shiva, Shakti are to be united, and Kundalini Yoga and so on deals with that. There is also the Buddhistic form in which not Shakti, but Prajna, wisdom, receives the main emphasis. Wisdom is invariably linked with compassion, Karuna. Indeed, wisdom is compassionate wisdom, even as compassion is wise compassion. You can't separate the two. For both wisdom and compassion in reality are transcendental functions beyond all duality, two forms of one energy, two faces, if you like, of the same being. Wisdom is a faculty of the living, pure mind embodied within us. It does not function in terms of mental constructs, fixed mental ideas. Our mental card index, so to say, by means of which we are able to recognize in our everyday experience the immediate percept. You look at an object and say, oh, that's a tree. You're able to say that because you have this mental card index on which the idea of tree and its appearance, its characteristics and so forth are all there, already present, because of our experience from infancy onwards. So this card index is formed of concepts. The trouble with concepts is that whilst concepts are indispensable for our existence, they dismiss the immediate perceiving. They tend to dismiss the immediate perceiving. You look at an object and say, oh, that's a tree. And you are not in communion with it then. You have dismissed it. Oh, that's my wife, or that's my husband. Just like that. But if we can see and hear and touch anything and everything as if for the first time, can you recall that sense of wonder as a little infant looking at things? You looked at this, you looked at the other, you looked at your mother, you looked at the dog, the cat, and of course you can't remember that part of it. Your eyes never blinked. It's astonishing how a child looks like that. It is perceiving, but it doesn't know what it is perceiving. See? Now the concept, once the concept forms, you get the power of cognition, of recognition. So the trouble with concepts is that they dismiss your immediate percept, which is the living experience now. On the other hand, without concepts, you can't structure your percepts and make them a meaningful pattern. Now, the yogi has to realize all this and develop the power not to dismiss the living percept because of the activity of the concept. So, wisdom is a faculty of the pure mind embodied within us. When wisdom functions, then only pure intelligence is active. It sees truth now. Intuition is not wisdom or pure intelligence. Wisdom, a living faculty, grows from within. It cannot be acquired from or given to others. It cannot be taught. Wisdom cannot be misused. By contrast, knowledge can be given or acquired, learned or taught, sought and found and stored. But knowledge, like any tool or any source of power, is inevitably misused unless and until the harmony of wisdom and compassion is established in us. This is a significant contrast between the practice of yoga along the lines of Shakti and of Prajna Karuna. It is therefore most important to note that both Hindu and Buddhist yoga imperatively demanded the basis of pure morality in thought and speech, feeling and motive and action before proceeding with asanas and pranayama, and before using mantras and mudras, that is, correctly intoned sounds and meaningful symbolic gestures. It should be clearly understood that a fundamental purpose of yoga is to heal the person who devotes himself to living the yogic life. Heal not merely in the biologic sense, but in the total sense. This means the realization of such holiness that the power of the universal divine mind freely functions in and through his pure, transparent psyche and his trained body. In other words, the true yogi lives constantly in the meditative state throughout the day. Now, do not imagine, therefore, that he is lost in the clouds, just daydreaming. That is not the meditative state at all. The meditative state is the state of complete, fully conscious communion here and now throughout the day. You are aware of it. You are all here, all there. You are not lost anywhere. He is, in his every action, word and thought, in the state of perfect communion. He offers no obstruction to the free inflow and outflow of transcendence through his temporal being, which is the mortal, finite being. Thus we see why yoga, whether Hindu or Buddhist, centers its main teaching on meditation and the discipline of the mind, on purification and the discipline of the psyche, and lastly, on the physical body. The Buddhist approach is specifically helpful for understanding the nature and functioning of the mind and of our own consciousness. The human being of our everyday experience is a psychophysical organism, a body-mind creature. His fivefold nature is presented, this is the Buddhistic presentation of the person, the analysis of what the person is presented as shape or form, mainly, of course, our own body, therefore. I say mainly for this reason. Thoughts, feelings, they all have shape and form. And the Buddhist analysis uses the wider term rather than the restricted term of body. And for Buddhist psychology, the body is not regarded as a distinct material object, an objective reality, separate from mind. It is classified as one of the six constituents of consciousness. It's an extraordinary thing. It's a constituent of consciousness. Because it is through the functioning of our senses, through the functioning of our consciousness as such, cognizing what we commonly call matter, that we see matter. Hear, touch, taste, and so on, what we call objects. So, they prefer to include it in the psychological context rather than in a context of its own. So, we have shape or form, that is one aspect of its fivefold nature, feelings, perceptions, volitions, and his dualistic, discriminative consciousness. These five are called skandhas, or groups. Skandhas means groups, which are functionally connected with one another, are not to be regarded as separate parts, adding up to a whole individual, but as five phases which occur in every complete process of consciousness. Thus, first, there is contact of the bodily senses with objects, which we call sparsha, contact. Second, that's the second phase, where there is contact, there is feeling, vedana. Where there is feeling, there is perception, samjna. Difficult word to pronounce, samjna. Where there is perception, there is volition, which produces mental formations, mental patterns, which characterize our own particular individual living process. This is where particularly we differ from everybody else. Each person is unique in his own way. And they are the samskaras. And fifthly, the full awareness belonging to one of six classes of consciousness according to the nature of the object. We may ask, what are these six classes of consciousness? And the Buddhist analysis presents it this way. They are due to sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell, etc. And in Buddhist psychology, in the Pali language, they literally call these different types of consciousness, eye consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, for the sense of touch, body consciousness, and lastly, the sixth one, you got the five ordinary senses as such, each of, and lastly, the sixth one, what is called, what they call mind consciousness, manovijnana. Manovijnana, and this sixth class is defined as intellectual consciousness, which sorts out and judges the results of the five kinds of sense consciousness, followed by attraction or repulsion and the illusion of an objective world to which one gets bound by action. You see, when each of these sense consciousness functions, there is a bodily sense function, consciousness functions, there is a response from the psyche in terms of, I like this, I don't like it. I want to have this, I don't want to have that. I want more of it, and, oh, I dislike this, I want to get rid of it, I want to destroy it. So you see, attachment, aversion grew. And you get on the one hand, bondage to craving, and on the other hand, bondage to violence, hate, destruction. You want to get rid of what you don't like, or to destroy it. Now watch human life very carefully, not only in oneself, but through the ages. And there has been the source of conflict. It's the psyche which is the nigger in the wood pile, so to say. You see? It is the psyche which is the source of the trouble. The body has a natural pleasure-pain mechanism. This is nature's gift. If nature didn't put a pleasure-pain mechanism inside the body, we wouldn't survive a few minutes even. It is this mechanism which enables us to withdraw from that which would destroy us and to carry on with that which will enable us to continue life and to live. But the psyche produces the conflicting state. So now, manovijnana is what we call our empirical consciousness. It is the sixth class of consciousness, this mental consciousness. The Buddha declared that the idea of a separate personal self or an eternal, unchanging, eternal, unchangeable individual ego as an identifiable entity, note very carefully, as an identifiable entity through all space and time, was an illusion. The very word entity means that which comes into being, proceeds, and comes to an end. The word entity means birth and inevitably death. So, to postulate a personal ego which exists forever and ever through time is an illusion altogether and has been responsible for untold harm to the individual in his life as well as to the human race. It's a terrific... It is a revelation which is by no means pleasant. We don't understand immortality. We ask deathlessness for that which essentially is something which undergoes that creative pulse where life and death take place almost simultaneously. And in that there is a process of transformation. It is the eternal, the absolute, the spirit, the one and only total reality, the primordial creative energy, which is. All else is the process of manifestation of that primordial creative energy through transformation after transformation. We have to perform our duty here Ask the rose. Ask the butterfly. Does it want to live forever and ever? If it could speak our language, it will say, what nonsense are you talking about? The Buddha taught that the principle of impermanence, I prefer the word relativity to impermanence myself, but that is how it has come through the Pali Canon. The principle of impermanence, anityata, was of the nature of all phenomena and all forms of life. Every phenomenon appears, proceeds, dies. Strictly speaking, we live only in the single moment of thought. We have lived in the past moment, which is no longer here. We will live in the next moment, which still has to come. This immediate now, the here now, is the only actual living moment. We die from one into the other continuously. But in the dying from this into that, that is alive, isn't it? And that which is alive dies into the next thing, which is the next moment, which is alive. This is the great thing to bear in mind. And if you can work upon this in deep meditation, you will experience the real meaning of immortality. The continuously changing world process is like a river which cannot flow backwards. The change is not fortuitous, arbitrary, or chaotic, but in accordance with the law of mutual dependence. Because this is here and this is here, therefore that happens. And since the whole process is a continuously changing process in which all the individual parts are dependent upon each other, there is this continuity as such. An interdependence, in fact, of phenomena. This is the Buddhist meaning of causality, of karma. Thus we see the dynamic nature of consciousness and existence. Like a river which, although continually changing its elements, keeps up the direction of its movement and preserves its relative identity. Now this is very different from believing in a permanent identifiable entity. A changeless thing like that is a static thing. It doesn't grow, it doesn't live, therefore it's a fossil. But the entire universe and modern science during the last few years has shown that the same applies to what we commonly call matter. Is a living universe. There is nothing which is dead and continues to be. This stream was called the subconscious stream of becoming, the Bhavanga Sutta. The existence of this stream cannot be questioned. It is there. We experience it. We live through it. Its factual reality consists in its continuity and in the steadiness and regularity of the relations prevailing within its components. The observation of this continuity gives rise to our self-consciousness, which is a function of manas, mind. See, Sanskrit has the advantage over other languages. It has several words to represent different aspects and functions of what we lump in one word as mind or as mental. Now, The observation of this continuity gives rise to our self-consciousness and therefore our sense of separate egohood, which is one of the root sources of our troubles. And the yoga is intended to liberate us from that illusion and that delusive state of consciousness. Now, this manas is the seventh class of consciousness. The object of this seventh class is not the sense world. It doesn't observe or function through the sense world, but the ever-flowing stream of becoming, or what modern psychologists in the West have called depth consciousness. It is the emanation and manifestation of the basic universal consciousness, the eighth class, which is the all-embracing consciousness, what is called in theistic religions the omniscience of God, which is called in Hindu terms, in Brahmanical terms, when they talk of Brahman, the absolute all, they say Brahman is Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat means being, eternal being. Chit, consciousness. This all-inclusive, all-embracing, utterly pure consciousness. And Ananda, a bliss, which you and I can never define or imagine. And that is in the Buddhist terms the Alaya Vijnana, that eighth class. Now this Alaya Vijnana is like the ocean into which rivers flow and lose their separate identity. On the surface of the ocean are witnessed disturbances. Deep down, the ocean is pure, clear, and untroubled. Universal mind is free of all relativity. It is undisturbed by egoism, unruffled by distinctions, desires, aversions. In the region where universal consciousness overlaps our empirical consciousness, manas functions, taking part in both sides. It is the stabilizing element of the mind, the central point of balance. But it is also the cause of the conception of separate egohood in the unenlightened person. This is its defilement. On the other hand, it can be one with universal mind when there is a true metanoia, a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, when we truly see that the wretchedness of the worldly life is due to our ignorance of the absolute, of the unborn, unbecome, unmade, of the emptiness and the suchness of total reality. Now we can begin to see the practice in Buddhist terms of yoga in daily life. When we truly see our ignorance, first the skanda or group of consciousness, vijnana, undergoes transformation into the wisdom, the prajna, of the universal law and ultimate reality. This is called the Dharma Dhatu wisdom. Second, the skanda, the group of shape and form, transforms into what is called the mirror-like wisdom. The passing shape and form does not deceive us, for in the steady, shining mirror of universal mind, all forms are seen reflected in their undistorted and pristine purity. Third, the isolatively self-centered consciousness associated with the shape, with the skanda of feeling, our feelings, transforms through the practice of universal love and sympathy, Maitri and Karuna, into the equalizing wisdom. That is, the essential identity of all beings, of mankind, of the whole cosmos. This sense of separation, this sense of I don't accept you, but I accept you. You see, all that is out. You have no enemies, you have no friends. Where the human race is concerned, everyone is one's fellow being. We can't deny nature's fact, can we? But that, instead of being a mere thought, becomes part and parcel of your natural, everyday consciousness, acting spontaneously. And then mankind can live as mankind. Then the word social, society, can have a meaning. It hasn't begun to have a meaning yet. And this is transformed, this is the meaning of the equalizing wisdom. Fourth, the consciousness associated with the skanda, the group of sense perceptions and intellectual discrimination, transforms into the clear vision in the deep states of meditation and into the faultless perception by unerring insight, pure buddhi, of discriminative wisdom. Discriminative in this context, which is a transcendental context now, not of separating things out and keeping them separate, but recognizing exactly what is there. To see the truth of things directly, immediately, wholly, unerringly. It's an extraordinary thing. Then there is infinite light, infinite splendor. The special foundation for this transformation is the total unreserved feeling of complete unity with all beings and things, namely the equalizing wisdom. And fifth and last, the skanda of ego-bound, karma-creating volitions or mental formations transforms into the all-accomplishing wisdom of what ought to be done, into the karma-free activity of an enlightened one, not motivated by desire or attachment, but by pure compassion of the perfected, liberated Holy One. Such a being, in his everyday thought and feeling, speech and action, is the embodiment and exemplar of yoga in daily life.